Well met, and welcome to episode 14, the Bill/Shakespeare Project podcast for October 11th, 2009. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Greetings, this is Bill Walthall, and this week we're going to jump into the discussion of the first part of Henry VI. Now, let's start off with the difficulty of doing a synopsis for the history plays. These are the most cinematic of Shakespeare's plays. On average, the histories have more scenes than any other genre, with tragedies being a close second. So sit down, relax, this is going to be a long one. The first scene of the first part of Henry VI has a take-notice beginning, a funeral march for Henry V, with John, Duke of Bedford, Humphrey, Duke of Gloucester, the Duke of Exeter, the Earl of Warwick, the Bishop of Winchester, and the Duke of Somerset. Now, all of these guys are interrelated. John, Duke of Bedford, and Humphrey, Duke of Gloucester are brothers to the late king. Humphrey, the younger, is now the Lord Protector for the young king. More on that youth later. The Duke of Exeter is Thomas Beaufort. The Bishop of Winchester is his younger brother, Henry Beaufort, and the Duke of Somerset is their nephew, Edmund Beaufort, son of their late brother John. And the Earl of Warwick is Richard de Beauchamp, a distant cousin. Now, Shakespeare, even in his factual histories, will at times play fast and loose with characters, places, and times. However, if this scene takes place in 1422, the year of Henry V's death, then Bedford is 33 years old, Gloucester, the protector, is 31, Exeter is 45, the bishop 47, and Somerset a mere 16. Warwick would be 40 years old. Henry V was 35 at his death, and had he lived, he would have inherited the throne of France, won in his wars in France, the 100 Years' War, as depicted in Henry V. But we won't get to that play for another year and a month from now. After the funeral march, the scene begins with Bedford and Gloucester praising their late brother. Exeter insinuates that the French may have been responsible for Henry's death through conjurers and sorcerers by magic verses. If French witchcraft was responsible for Henry's death, the bishop states that the church's prayers made him more prosperous. Not surprising, this is coming from the bishop. Now, Gloucester doesn't buy this, hinting that it may have also been the church who prayed for Henry's death so that the new king would be a schoolboy the church may overawe. Gloucester and the Bishop of Winchester continue to argue until Bedford shuts the quarrel down by invoking the late king's spirit to keep England from civil brawls. Now might be a good time to mention this. King Henry VI was only 9 months old when he assumed the throne of England. So you can see how this whole Lord Protector thing is important, as well as the ability to overawe the young king. And you can see where this is going, can't you? Familial squabbles that grow into civil war. And let's see, the squabbles had their root in more than trivial things that happened a generation or two before. Now, Bedford's prayer is interrupted by a series of messengers, and the messages aren't good. There has been a revolt in many French cities, and the English have already lost a number of them. If that wasn't bad enough, not only are individual towns revolting, but the Prince Dauphin Charles has named himself king and is pulling together the existing nobility of France for a national revolt. And then, the worst. The badass British general Lord Talbot has been captured and is now being held prisoner. Now, Bedford and Gloucester are ready for war, and even Exeter seems to bring along the Beauforts. They will remember their promises to King Henry V and join forces to defeat the common enemy, France. Gloucester says that he will head to the Tower of London to check on musicians, then crown young Henry as king. Exeter says that he will then take the king to Eltham for safety. Everyone leaves the stage, leaving the Bishop of Winchester alone, and he confides to the audience that he intends to steal the king from Eltham and become the main advisor to the boy. The setting then moves to France. Remember, Shakespeare, when it comes to the French, is an Anglo-centric historian. So needless to say, the French do not come off well here. The Dauphin Charles and his comrades, including René, Duke of Anjou, file that name away in the memory banks for later, come off as preening and arrogant. They begin to attack the English troops. The French lords return to the stage having been beaten back by the English with great loss. It's a French army joke. The lords then spend time lionizing the English forces and soldiers. Shakespeare knew who was buying the tickets. And into this pity party comes the Bastard of Orleans. and how would you like to have that be your moniker? And he has brought some good news, or at least some help. A holy maid. And who would this maid be? Joan La Pucelle, Joan of Arc, a French saint, though not until the 20th century. And since she's French, she doesn't get the best treatment from Shakespeare. She knows things that she should not, the Dauphin's identity, so she's either a con artist or a witch or both. In a weirdly sexualized job interview with the Dauphin, she not only explains her history, but also beats the Dauphin in single combat. This is the trifecta for Shakespeare. Joan is a whore, the sexualized speech. Joan is a witch. How else could she win in combat? And Charles is a puss. See that last reason. Now the Dauphin gives her the defense of Orléans. He has nothing to lose. The city is besieged and is going down to defeat. If she wins, he's got himself a force to be reckoned with. And if not, he's lost nothing. Now, when scene 4 begins, we're back in England, as Gloucester, remember, Henry V's brother Humphrey and Lord Protector of the infant King Henry VI, goes to the Tower of London to check the armory for the reinvasion of France. He fears that there's been conveyance or theft, and when he arrives, he finds the gates are locked, and his guards are no longer outside the gates. He is refused entrance under orders of the Bishop of Winchester, so that quarrel from the first scene is continued. Winchester calls Gloucester a most usurping prodigal, and here we may very well begin to see the roots of the quarrel. Usurpation is a strong term, not stronger than traitor, prodigal, but strong nevertheless, and it makes reference to Gloucester's father, King Henry IV, who usurped the crown from Richard II. It's unclear at this point whether Winchester anticipates Gloucester usurping power from young Henry VI. This is hinted by Winchester's refutation of Gloucester's title of Lord Protector, or if he's using the usurping prodigal bit to paint Gloucester's entire family line, including, one would think, the infant king, as usurpers. This is pretty interesting given that the two men are related. Gloucester's grandfather is Winchester's father, John of Gaunt. Gloucester's father, Henry IV, was from Gaunt's first marriage to Blanche of Lancaster. Winchester was from Gaunt's third marriage to Catherine Swinford, who had been his longtime mistress. Their relationship was legitimized when their offspring were well into their 20s. Now, one of John of Gaunt's four surviving brothers, two more died in infancy, was Edward, the Black Prince of Wales, father to Richard II, who was overthrown by Henry IV. So Winchester's painting of Gloucester's line as usurpers would not apply to himself or his Beaufort brethren. Now, in response to accusations of treason and usurpation, Gloucester hits the bishop with accusations of pimping and venereal disease. As the two men's parties grow closer to physical combat, the mayor of London arrives to break up the fight. The two parties leave, but not before hurling more insults at each other. And if the mayor is on any side in this quarrel, it seems to be Gloucester, as he says of Winchester, "The bishop is more haughty than the devil." And the scene ends. Now, the remaining four scenes of Act 1 are of a piece, like scenes 2 and 3. Again, we're back in France and at war. A French gunner is relieved at his post by his son. The French have aimed a piece of artillery at the watchtower the English have used to spy over the French movements. The gunner tells his son that if he sees anything, he's to call his father immediately. The son, seemingly in an attempt to be his own man, says after his father leaves, "I'll never trouble you if I may spy them." We then turn to the English up in the tower, referenced before, and we finally meet Lord Talbot, the terror of the French, as well as Salisbury and two others. Talbot recounts to Salisbury his time in captivity before Bedford had ransomed him. It wasn't pleasant, but it wasn't too bad, as the French were afraid of him. Then shots are heard, and Salisbury and Gargrave fall. It seems the French boy turned out to be a pretty good shot. Talbot is pretty distraught over the loss of Salisbury, and as he bemoans his loss, a messenger comes to deliver the news that the Dauphin has been successful in gathering a great power because he is now teamed with Joan La Pucelle. In Talbot's anger, he rushes off to leave his position to take the fight to the French. In the ensuing battle, Joan takes Orléans, where Joan is reunited with the French nobles who now believe her claims. The Dauphin Charles even proclaims that he will divide his crown with her, and declares that she will be France's saint because of this golden day of victory. The English soldiers later succeed in chasing off the French, and then the French nobles arrive to survey the area and bemoan their situation, whining that they had to leave their beds. While the Bastard of Orléans demonizes Talbot by calling him a fiend from hell, René of Anjou, remember that name? Well, continue to do so, responds, "If not of hell, the heavens sure favor him." Then, the Dauphin and Joan arrive, and Charles is not happy, even accusing her of setting up the French with the victory at Orléans so that this defeat would be 10 times so much more painful. A messenger arrives at Talbot's camp with an invitation to Talbot to visit the Countess of Auvergne, so that she may boast that she hath beheld the man whose glory fills the world with loud report. Burgundy jokes that Talbot's martial exploits are turning into a peaceful comic sport where ladies crave to be encountered with. Encountered here, having a double meeting, and also participating in an amatory interview or a wooing. Talbot responds that he will grant her visit out of politeness, but neither Burgundy nor Bedford will accompany Talbot. Bedford, out of politeness, demurs because he wasn't invited. Before Talbot leaves, he whispers something into an English captain's ear. Now, at the Countess's castle, we learn that her invitation was a trap, one to make her famous by this exploit. When Talbot arrives, she tells him that he is now her prisoner, and he only laughs. She insults him more, and he responds by saying that she's right, he's but a shadow of who he is. And when she's confused by this answer, he clarifies matters by blowing a horn. His troops, presumably led by the English captain into whose ear Talbot had whispered at the end of the previous scene, then charge into the room. She immediately changes tone and begs him to pardon her abuse. Talbot is gracious, saying that what she has done hath not offended him. He only wants wine and cates for his men, and the scene ends with her honored to feast so great a warrior in her house. Next scene is set in a rose briar, and here the members of the two quarreling factions meet. No, not the Gloucester-Winchester factions. Those factions seem to be more concerned with who shall have control over young Henry. No, these factions quarrel is over who should be king in the first place. In this scene, we meet Richard Plantagenet. Also in the briar are Warwick, Somerset, a Beaufort, Suffolk, Vernon, and a lawyer. But it is Richard Plantagenet who is of most importance here. Now back in, or depending on how you want to look at it, next year in Henry V, three conspirators are found out and sentenced to death. One of them was Richard, Earl of Cambridge. This Richard's father was Edmund, Duke of York, who was brother to John of Gaunt, the grandfather to Henry V. Richard, Earl of Cambridge, had all of his titles and estates stripped from him because of the treachery. Richard Plantagenet is the son of that Richard, Earl of Cambridge, and of Anne Mortimer, the daughter of Roger Mortimer, who had been the presumptive heir to Richard II, whom, remember, Henry V's father, Henry IV, overthrew. Now, Richard Plantagenet and the Duke of Somerset are having a debate of some kind, and they want Warwick to judge the merits of their cases. Of course, neither begins by giving any support to their claim. It really feels more like a high school popularity contest. Plantagenet plucks a white rose and calls upon his followers to do the same. Somerset plucks a red rose and calls upon his followers to do the same. Warwick sides with Plantagenet, Suffolk with Somerset, then both Vernon and the lawyer with Plantagenet. Only then do we get to see what the argument is really about, the line to the throne of England. Warwick supports Plantagenet because his grandfather was Lionel, Duke of Clarence, third son of the third Edward, King of England. His lineage is meaningless, argues Somerset, because Plantagenet's father was a traitor. Plantagenet argues that while his father was condemned to die for treason, he wasn't a traitor, as his case never came before Parliament. After Somerset and Suffolk leave, Warwick predicts that the next meeting of Parliament, called for the Truce of Winchester and Gloucester, will bring about the end of the blot against Plantagenet, and that he will be granted the title Duke of York. Even if this happens, however, Plantagenet predicts this quarrel will drink blood another day. This pretty much foreshadows the next three plays. This whole scene depicts a symbolic beginning of the War of the Roses. If that scene plants a seed, the next adds water for growth. We now meet Edmund Mortimer, aged and imprisoned in the London Tower. Mortimer, remember that name? We mentioned that Richard, Earl of Cambridge, married Anne Mortimer? Well, Edmund is Anne's brother, also a legitimate claimant to the throne. As I noted, he's imprisoned, and he's old. He seems to be a man on his last legs, and he expects to see his nephew, Plantagenet. He wishes Plantagenet's troubles would end, and for him to have his titles and estates reinstated. Plantagenet arrives, and Mortimer explains to him in more detail the politics of advancement to the throne. The explanation is really more for us. Plantagenet would have known the story all too well. Henry and his line derive from John of Gaunt, fourth-born son of Edward III. Mortimer's line comes from Lionel, the third-born son of Edward III. For the Mortimers and the Plantagenets, the math is simple. Third is better than fourth. But there's a hitch, one that Mortimer mentions, but doesn't or can't discuss in full. He's descended from Lionel through his father's mother. And since this is pre-Elizabethan England, this is an issue. Only those males who descend through male royals need apply. The Mortimers are out of luck. And since Mortimer then proclaims Plantagenet art Mortimer's heir, Plantagenet is out of luck too. But luck will have nothing to do with this. In a moment of high drama, Mortimer dies after saying a final goodbye to Plantagenet. He's going to get his titles and estates back, or he's going to force the issue, use the political slight as a launching point for his own political advantage. Act 3 begins with a meeting of the English nobles, including, for the first time in the play, our title character, young King Henry. Exeter, Gloucester, and Winchester are all in attendance, as are Somerset and Suffolk, wearing red roses, and Warwick and Richard Plantagenet, with white ones. Get your roses here, folks. Can't tell your characters without your roses. Now, the starting stage directions ends with Gloucester offers to put up a bill, Winchester snatches it, and tears it. Obviously, the king's presence is not enough to prevent their squabbles. In fact, after listening to them spar back and forth, before Henry says even his first words, he can only beg them to play nice. The meeting is interrupted by the sounds of chaos outside, and the mayor of London informing them that the followers of Gloucester and Westminster are throwing rocks at each other outside. Now, if it wasn't so bloody, it'd be pretty damn funny, especially when the brawl outside spills over into the room where everybody is. King Henry tries to stop the riot, but no one listens to him. He finally orders his uncle, "Pray, Uncle Gloucester, mitigate this strife." The boy is king, but he has no power. The skirmish continues, and Gloucester attempts to bring it to an end unsuccessfully, as Winchester will not. It's only after Henry rebukes Winchester that the bishop takes Gloucester's hand, and the skirmish is over. For now. Only then can the matter of Plantagenet's reinstatement be brought before the king. Gloucester, idealistic to a fault, lobbies for Plantagenet, and King Henry grants the request to make him Duke of York. All the nobles, save Somerset, show pleasure for this, and even he keeps his thoughts to himself, or at least in an aside. As the scene ends, Exeter is left alone on stage, and he can see that all of this is just feigned ashes of forged love, and not enough to avert the prophecy that Henry born at Monmouth should win all, and Henry born at Windsor should lose all. The rest of Act 3 all takes place on the war plains of France. Joan takes Rouen, then the French taunt the English from the walls of the city. Like Mortimer in Act before, Bedford, the regent of France, and the uncle to the young king dies. Spurred by this, the French retake the city. Later, the French nobles call for a parley with Burgundy, during which Joan convinces him to rejoin the French cause, and even Burgundy isn't sure if he hasn't been bewitched. In the final scene of Act 3, King Henry and his nobles all arrive in France and meet with Talbot. Henry thanks Talbot for his service and makes him Earl of Shrewsbury. When the others leave, Vernon and Bassett quarrel over their respective sides in the, for now, skirmish of the roses. Act 4 begins with Henry's coronation on French soil. Before Gloucester can secure an oath of loyalty from the governor of Paris, however, a letter arrives from Burgundy, a kind of Dear John letter of national proportions. Henry responds quickly, "Why then, Lord Talbot there shall talk with him and give him chastisement for this abuse." What? Talk? Chastisement? That's pretty weak. After Talbot leaves on his mission, Vernon and Bassett, servants to Plantagenet and Somerset respectively, ask for Henry's permission to fight a duel. The cause? You guessed it, they talked smack about each other's mothers, I mean roses. When Henry balks at letting them get ready to rumble, both Plantagenet, now Duke of York, and Somerset request that the servants be allowed to fight it out, and if not the servants, then the men themselves. As Somerset says, "The quarrel toucheth none but us alone, betwixt ourselves let us decide it then." Both Gloucester and Exeter try to get the two to settle the quarrel and be friends. Henry then goes on to tell them that as long as they are in France, they must work together, else the French will see the dissension and it will provoke them to greater rebellion. Smart. Not so smart when he begins to address the whole rose issue. He says, "Let me be umpire in this doubtful strife. I see no reason, if I wear this rose," he takes a red one, "that anyone should therefore be suspicious. I am more inclined to Somerset than York. Both are my kinsmen, and I love them both." Whoops. After Henry and his followers leave York, Warwick, Vernon, and Exeter on stage, York states, "I like it not in that he wears the badge of Somerset." Warwick tries to convince York that it was just young Henry's fancy and that he thought no harm, but York is dubious. Once York and his followers leave the stage to Exeter, we see that he can see where all of this is going. More rancorous spite, more furious raging broils that yet can be imagined or supposed. Next, Talbot seeks the surrender of the town of Bordeaux. The French general refuses, saying that the Dauphin's army is coming. Talbot realizes that with the approaching army, the odds are very much against him and his men. Elsewhere in France, York is waiting for horses so that he can ride to Talbot's aid. York blames the lack of horses on, guess who? Somerset. William Lucy, who has delivered word of Talbot's situation, also informs York and us that Talbot has been joined by his son, young John. They have been separated for 7 years, and now they're together and facing certain death. And to hear York tell it, the fault lies with Somerset. Lucy then rides to Somerset. Somerset blames Talbot's situation on both Talbot himself and York, whose battle plan was too rashly plotted. As the blame game plays out, we see the reunion of father and son. Talbot attempts to convince his son to flee the battle and to live to revenge his death. The son will have none of it, stating that if anyone should flee, it should be his father. His rationale? Talbot's heroic exploits have purchased for him freedom from any stained honor, while fleeing by the as-yet unbattle-tested young Talbot would be seen as sheer cowardice. When neither can convince the other to flee, they go off, side by side, together to live and die. In battle, Talbot saves his son from slaughter, and then they and the English drive off the French. And while father has rescued son, the son has sparked admiration from the father. He is proud of what his son has accomplished on the field of battle, and now he begs again for him to flee. When young Talbot refuses again to flee and live, his father can only offer a dark alternative. If thou wilt fight, fight by thy father's side, and commendable proved, let's die in pride. In scene 7, we see the result. Talbot is helped on stage by a servant, and the old warrior recounts what has happened. Talbot had fallen on the field of battle, but his son had stood over him and rescued him, committing rough deeds of rage. He is proud of his son, but devastated. After young Talbot had saved his father, he charged into another skirmish with the French and was killed. His son's body is brought on stage, and Talbot holds him in his arms. The grief is overbearing, and the old man dies, holding his late son. The French enter, and the English flee, leaving the bodies behind for the Dauphin and his nobles to find. Mostly they praise both father and son, only mostly because the bastard of Orléans wants to hew them, hack their bones. What a bastard! William Lucy then comes to find out the fate of Talbot and is allowed to take the bodies back to the English, and that is the last image of Act 4. Act 5 begins with Henry asking Gloucester if the Lord Protector has read the letters from the Pope and the Earl of Armagnac. The letters request that Henry end his military excursion to France and enter a time of peace. Henry agrees that this makes sense. The Armagnac letter, however, has an additional part, an offer of the Earl's daughter in marriage. As he is near net to Charles, this would seem to make the peace between England and France a little more secure. Not that it worked in this case. Remember that Henry's mother was Catherine, Princess of France. Henry is a little unsure, as his years are young, but he will be well content with any choice tends to God's glory and my country's weal. Gloucester thinks that the offer is a good one, so Henry agrees to marriage. Winchester arrives, now in a cardinal's habit rather than his old bishop's, and with a papal legate. Exeter is Winchester's older brother, but even he doesn't trust him, and that mistrust is well laid. When left on stage alone with the legate, Winchester admits having bribed the Pope for his new cardinalship. And if that wasn't bad enough, when left alone, he informs the audience that he will make Gloucester stoop and bend his knee or sack this country with a mutiny. Now, if this is Act 5 of the first part, can we see this as the creation of a villain for the second part? Now, the French nobles begin to celebrate the Parisians' revolt, only to learn that the English army, once split in two, have regrouped and is heading for battle. The French can only hope that the English, without Talbot, do not have the power to defeat them. We see the repercussions of the French doubt in scene 3, and this is the single most wacky scene in the entire play. Joan La Pucelle calls forth her fiends to grant her victory over the English. If the play up to this point has been ambiguous in its hatred of Joan, only through dialogue of those who hate both her and the French, that ambiguity disappears with the appearance of her speedy helpers. Of course, they don't help Joan in this scene, but their mere appearance on stage shows that for the purposes of the play, Joan is a witch. This scene, wacky though it is completely necessary for the rest of the La Pucelle subplot in the play. Immediately following is York's capture of Joan, and anyone with a brain or just an inkling of knowledge of how the 100 Years' War ended knows where this is going. To the stake. On the battlefield, Suffolk leads a French prisoner, Margaret. At first, we don't know who she is, but she tells Suffolk that she is the daughter of the King of Naples. And who is the King of Naples? René, Duke of Anjou. Remember that name, or at least our admonition earlier to remember that name? Here, that seed grows to fruition. And the fruit is comedy, at least for this scene. Both characters spend much of the scene speaking in asides, while the other tries to communicate unsuccessfully. Suffolk finds her beautiful and his fancy, but his ambition trumps his own desire. He will present her to Henry as a proper wife. After all, she's the daughter of a king. It takes a little convincing by Suffolk, but Margaret agrees as long as her father gives consent as well. And as luck would have it, Anjou arrives on the scene. And to create a peace in France, Anjou is more than willing to agree to the match. Suffolk will need to go to England to seal the deal, but he has difficulty saying goodbye to Margaret, calling her back time after time until the scene reaches a surprising, if not completely salacious or shocking, climax. He kisses her, and she accepts it. It would seem that Shakespeare is once again on the attack against non-English women, witches and sluts, hags and whores. This does not bode well for young Henry. Now, back in York's camp in France, he interrogates Joan. He has brought a shepherd who claims to be Joan's father, but Joan repeatedly denies this. When she does, the shepherd turns on her, telling York to burn her. Hanging is too good. As she's about to be taken away, she attempts to escape her execution by an entire menu of excuses. She's the progeny of kings. She's been chosen from above. She's a virgin, chaste and immaculate. Note, at this point, Warwick wants her burned quickly so her torture will be shortened. Very kind for the maid. She's also with child, although the father is assumed to be the Dauphin. But the father is Alison. No, wait. The father is René, King of Naples. If she's executed, mischief and despair will drive you to break your necks and hang yourselves. None of these arguments work. And off she goes. It's going to be a hot time in the camp tonight. And we, as an audience, have no problem with this, as we know from scene 3 that she's a witch, and burning was the standard punishment. Winchester arrives to let York, the new regent of France, know that the king wants peace with France, an effeminate peace, York derides. But orders are orders, so when the French nobles arrive, the peace is agreed upon. Scene 7, the final scene of the play, returns us to the palace in London. Suffolk has delivered news of Margaret's offer of marriage to Henry, and Henry is moved. Gloucester and Exeter both argue against it for reasons of the prior arrangement with Armagnac and Armagnac's greater political connections. Henry overrules for the first time the Lord Protector and agrees to the marriage with Margaret. The nobles leave, and the last person left on stage is Suffolk, who closes the play with, "Margaret shall now be queen and rule the king, but I will rule both her and king and realm." Between the Cardinal of Winchester and Suffolk, not to mention the continuing conflict between York and Somerset, the second part of Henry VI does not look to be a picnic for the young monarch. Now, if you've enjoyed this really long podcast, but you haven't been following along with our daily blog entries this week, you've missed out on subjects including in-depth synopses of all the acts, as well as a link to a flash-based genealogy of Shakespeare's English succession of kings. So, if you would like more in-depth discussions, or just want a daily fix, check out the blog entries at thebillshakespeareproject.com or at our Facebook page, though the Facebook page is more about Shakespeare news than daily discussions of our play of the month. And of course, you can join us again for our next podcast. We hope to see you then. You've been listening to the Bill/Shakespeare Project podcast for October 11th, 2009. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com, and we shall see thee anon.